Good morning, church family.
Good morning.
It's really good to see you guys. I've missed so many of you. So many of you I haven't seen since last year. I wrote that joke last week. Couldn't wait. So at the beginning of this year, we're going to start a new sermon series. It's called The Big Story. It's about getting familiar with God's timeline for us, God's big plan for us. Now, I call it a story because it has a beginning and an end, the beginning being God creating the world and the end being God restoring the world. And I say it's a big story because it deals with the biggest kind of problems, the fall of humanity, why the world is broken, and it deals with an even bigger solution, the redemption that we have in Jesus. Now, I can demonstrate this story to you in a number of different ways. I could draw little pictures to you. Maybe some of you have seen something like this. Some of you have a sign of this in your home. Some of you have it tattooed on your bodies, right? Like, I could draw little circles with arrows and crosses to show you pictorially what the gospel message is about. And I could do it like really quickly, like in a few minutes, and we could be done, right? But what I want to do, instead of just explaining things in kind of a cutesy way, is I want to go over the next few weeks about why this is so important. What makes this big story such a big deal? And so to do that, I think we have to ask kind of like all the big fundamental questions. It's like when you're a kid in school and your teacher teaches you to ask different questions. Most of them start with W. Who, what, when, where, why? And there's one H in there, how? We're going to be asking all kinds of questions about this story, about why it's so important. We're going to begin with a what question. This is the lesson for this week. It's called, what's wrong with the world? Now, a question like that, I think it's interesting. Because the way, if you were to ask somebody that, you could ask yourself that, you can ask your neighbor, you can ask a friend. If you ask somebody that, you're not just going to get what they think about that question. They're not just going to give you an answer. Their answer is going to tell you something about them. Their answer is going to tell you something about their personality, about their general disposition. And to kind of illustrate this, I have a clip of two people, and you could see that they kind of have different dispositions, different ways that they view the world just by the way that their conversation goes. So I've got about a 2-minute clip to get us started. Pay close attention. It's going to come up later. It's from what I think is the greatest romantic comedy of all time.
Story of my life isn't even going to get us out of Chicago. I mean, nothing's happened to me yet. That's why I'm going to New York.
So something happened to you?
Yes.
Like what?
I can go into journalism school to become a reporter.
So you can write about things that happen to other people?
That's one way to look at it.
Suppose nothing happens to you. Suppose you live there your whole life and nothing happens, you never meet anybody, you never become anything, and finally you die in one of those New York deaths that nobody notices for 2 weeks until the smell drifts into the hallway.
Amanda mentioned you had a dark side.
That's what drew me.
Your dark side.
Sure. Why don't you have a dark side? So that you're probably one of those cheerful people who dance around with little hearts.
I have just as much of a dark side as the next person.
Oh, really? When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends. That, my friend, is a dark side.
That doesn't mean you're deep or anything. I mean, yes, basically, I'm a happy person.
So am I.
And I don't see that there's anything wrong with that.
Of course not. You're busy being mad. Do you ever think about death?
Yes.
Sure you do. A fleeting thought that drifts in and out of the transom of your mind. I spend hours. I spend days.
And you think this makes you a better person?
No. But it comes down, I'm going to be prepared. And you're not. That's all I'm saying.
In the meantime, you're going to ruin your whole life waiting for it.
You see what I mean by different personalities, different dispositions towards life? He, Harry, called her Sally. He says, you must be one of those cheerful people. I bet you draw little hearts over your when you make your eyes, right? You're just too busy to think about the heavy stuff, right? But she says that you say that you have this dark side, but that doesn't make you deep or anything. You're going to ruin your life if you become preoccupied with things like death. We kind of see people's different personalities and dispositions when we ask this question. What is wrong with the world? It tells you something about people with the way that they talk about those things. So let's say we ask people, what is wrong with the world? How might they answer? What are the general possible answers that people would give to those questions? I can think of three general categories that we could categorize, I think, most people's answers to this question, what's wrong with the world? The first one would be, what do you mean? There's nothing wrong with the world, right? The people that say, it's like, what do you mean? Why you phrase the question like that? What's wrong with the world? There's nothing wrong with the world. These are the kind of people that are always, you know, the Louis Armstrong song is always in the back of their head. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world, right? You know, it's a wonderful world. What's wrong with the world? You could say nothing's wrong with the world. That's one possible answer. Another answer that you typically get if you ask people what's wrong with the world, sometimes they answer this in kind of a silly way. Sometimes they'll just say whatever is most recently been in the news, like a bad headline, right? And it's not that whatever the most recent, it's not like there was nothing wrong with the world until this latest headline came out, but it's the latest headline is the freshest example in their mind of what's wrong with the world. And usually what makes it into the news are things that have to do with human evil is what I would call it. There are so many examples of human evil, and like I can think of like a number of kind of pithy ways to say this. One that I've heard recently is people are meant to be loved and things are made to be used, but when people love things or when people love things and use people, that is human evil. So that's on the forefront of a lot of people's minds, is that human evil is what's wrong with the world. And finally, the third category that I think most people would answer, they would say something like what I would call natural evil. Those are bad things that happen even without human beings directly involved. These are things like hurricanes, earthquakes, diseases, medical issues, etc. Now, so those are, I think, the three general types of answers you would get, but what do we think of these answers? Now, I think if you were to press the person who says there's nothing wrong with the world, maybe they would concede a couple things. They would concede either that, you know, the world's not perfect, but it's good enough, right? It could theoretically be better, but let's just accept it as it is because it's all we're going to get. So why get preoccupied with what's wrong with the world? Or the person that says there's nothing wrong with the world, nothing seems to be going on in their world, a smaller world. They're really thinking about their own personal life, their own personal world, of them, maybe their close circle of friends, not the collective world as a whole. It's like, in my little bubble, there doesn't seem to be anything glaringly wrong. So we're going to talk more about this answer later. Now, human evil, I think, is a really good answer. Human evil is something that is critically, fundamentally wrong with the world, and I think the Bible would agree with this. And the Bible calls human evil, that is, bad things that humans are responsible for, we are guilty of, we're culpable for, that's what human evil is, the Bible would call that sin. Now, people may not call it sin, but it's true that that's at the core of what is wrong with the world. And we're going to hear even more about the nature of sin in later lessons. Now, about this natural evil, that I think is a really interesting answer. Because what makes natural things evil, right? The examples of what I said, earthquakes, hurricanes, you know, diseases, that kind of stuff, what makes those things wrong in and of themselves? Is there anything wrong with a big storm or plate tectonics knocking against each other or tiny organisms living inside bigger organisms? I don't think there's anything wrong in those things in and of themselves. They are evil. Here's what makes them evil. They are evil because they cause suffering and death. Let me put it this way. There could be like a big tropical storm out somewhere in the ocean affecting nobody, right? And we wouldn't call that evil, right? It becomes evil when that hurricane makes landfall, usually in a populated coastal area, and it brings suffering and death there. So when people give examples of natural evil, I think the real thing behind it that makes it evil is suffering and death. So I really want to zero in on death in this lesson. Oh, you signed up for a real upper this morning. You see, Harry brought it up in the clip, remember? He says, you ever think about death? She says, sure. He's like, yeah, a little. But do you really like wrestle with death and what it means? This is heavy stuff. Yeah, and I think it's worth thinking about. Like, it's going to happen to you. Death happens to all of this. Now, this lesson may get a little macabre, but this is how I think we should say it. This is how I would put it when we're talking about death. We are all hostages of death. We are trapped in death's grasp. It can take our lives, any one of us, at any moment, and it seems like we don't have it in our power to escape it. You ever really think about that? I think about this sometimes. Sometimes I'm up at night. It's like, no matter what I do, it's like death has power over me. Death can come for me at any moment. Have you come to terms with death? Now, Harry and Sally both say that they have thought about how to deal with death, even though they have very different approaches, very different dispositions, right? But I think it's worth saying, how can we humans deal with death? How is it we think about it? How is it we rationalize it? I have one last 2-minute video clip of how human beings come to death. It's from one of my favorite creators, CGP Grey. I'm going to play it. Pay close attention. He's kind of notorious for going really fast. Okay, so 2 minutes. How do human beings come to terms with death?
When do you want to die? The Reaper is busy, but he can fit you in right now. Too soon, later perhaps. Future you will keep the appointment, old and with a life fully lived, perhaps ever so slightly bored and ready. Now you might think that, but when the appointment whippersnapper you set comes, it is not in the future, because you don't live in the future. You always live in the now, and thus you always die now. Because the Reaper comes for all eventually, humans have formed a relationship with death. Reverse. Like a hostage who grows to love their kidnapper, humans tell themselves the handful of decades the Reaper gives them is just the right length, that living a truly long and healthy life would get boring and would be unnatural, and imagine all the problems if death took a holiday. And so the Reaper of Age whispers that he is your friend, always near, growing humans bigger, stronger, healthier, and smarter. At first, then comes his harvest of slow rot. Death is a part of life, he whispers. Death gives life meaning. This is madness. Misery doesn't give happiness meaning. Happiness is meaning itself. If you tortured people to make them better appreciate the pleasures of life, you would be a monster, just like this guy. No parent would ask the Reaper of Age to wrinkle their child's skin, weaken their bones, dim their vision, and their minds, cripple them in 1,000 ways over decades to ultimately kill them, to give their life meaning. But what can you do? The world contains pain and death, and so your brain believes the sweet lies that the horrors you can't avoid are good for you. And while death is a part of life, cholera was a part of life until humans developed wells and sewers to separate water from waste. Short-sightedness is a part of life until it isn't. Just because a thing is natural doesn't make it good or necessary. It's natural to live lives nasty, brutish, and short, and it's natural for humans to look at what indifferent nature provides as the starting point, as a to-do list.
So there's a lot there, but I think it's worth saying, how do human beings come to terms with death? Death is a hard thing to come to terms with, but what can we do? The world, just one of the things that's part of its nature, you might call it what it's wrong with the world, you might just say it's part of the world's nature, it's full of pain, suffering, and death, right? So our brains try to help us rationalize that by telling us the sweet lie, and it's sweet, but it is a lie, that somehow the horrors that we can't avoid, they're somehow good for us. That seems to make sense. Can't have good without bad. It sounds right. Just like it sounds like there's wisdom to say death gives meaning to life, right? But that is rightfully called crazy. He calls it madness. Given the option to go without death, we would not invite death upon ourselves or a loved one to give life meaning, any more than we would inflict pain on someone to better appreciate the pleasures of life. That is rightly called monstrous. Again, we are all hostages of death, and death is that monster that holds us all hostage. And in a desperate attempt to preserve our own sanity, some people have fallen into an insane and perverse way of thinking of their captor, of their hostage taker. That mental pathology is what explains the insane thought that pure happiness, it would somehow be incomplete without the miseries of pain and death. That attitude is rightly called madness. That's just as crazy as seeing suffering and death in the natural world and calling it beautiful in and of itself. Just because suffering and death are natural doesn't mean we should accept them. Though you can understand why people do, because they feel they're going to lose their minds if they don't accept it and they don't see any other valid option. It makes sense as a desperate effort to keep your sanity, but ironically, you go insane to try to make sense of the mad world that way. So what's wrong with the world? That's why I think this answer that nothing's wrong with the world, I think it's at best an ill-considered answer. Maybe someone who says something like that, there's nothing wrong with the world, we could call them, maybe they're inexperienced, maybe they just aren't aware of what's going on in the world, they're just not aware of what's wrong with the world. Or maybe, as I said before, they've shrunken their world down to a more manageable size. They've lowered their standards for what it takes for all to be right in their worlds. Now, I want to clarify. There's nothing wrong with having an optimistic disposition. There's nothing wrong with being a Pollyanna or a Sally or singing Louis Armstrong. There's nothing wrong with having a cheerful disposition. But it is wrong to call evil things good, and suffering and death, let me be clear, are evil things. Let's call them for what it is. Death and suffering are a big problem in the natural world. And look how Scripture describes it from Romans 8. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice. So it says creation here. So it's talking about the big world, the big picture. This is the big story we're talking about. And all creation is in a frustrating situation that it doesn't want to be in. It did not choose this. And if it had the choice, it would opt out of this. It continues, verse 20. Creation was subjected to frustration in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. So creation hopes to be liberated from the slow decay of death, the slow harvest of death. Death has creation in bondage, and again, we are all hostages of death. You can picture death's metaphorical prison for us as looking something like this. Breathe that in for a second. We don't like this, or we shouldn't, right? We should not be comfortable or complacent in a situation that looks like this. It makes sense that we would want freedom from this prison of death. So, going back to Romans 8, verse 22, we know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. So, big picture creation, it overlaps with our own personal world, our own personal experiences, as we're all groaning, waiting to become children of God. We groan as in childbirth. I have never given birth to a baby before, but I understand childbirth is pretty intense, right? It's like, I want this baby to be born already. I'm ready for these birth pains to be gone. So it's like this, we're groaning as in childbirth, except in this instance, the baby, you could say it's us, and we're being reborn, spiritually reborn into the family of God. We continue in Romans 8, verse 24. For in this hope we are saved, but hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? This is part of what the Christian hope is, that solution to that problem, the solution to the problem of death, which we're going to be talking about the solution throughout this series. But you can't understand the importance of that solution if you can't see that problem. If you don't see the problem with the world, you can't understand the importance of the Christian hope. Who hopes for what they already have? Or to put it another way, who looks for something better that they don't have when they have resigned themselves to settle for what they already have? So for those who are asked what is wrong with the world and are tempted to answer like, well, what do you mean? They want to deny what's wrong with the world. They want to say that there is nothing wrong with the world. Here's part of the challenge to you, right? Will you settle for life with all its miseries, or do you dare hope for something better? that's the application, if that's your disposition, if that's your position with looking at what's wrong with the world. But what if you were quick to name something that is wrong with the world? Are you better equipped to deal with death? Remember Harry from the clip? He had a very different disposition. He said he thinks about death all the time so that he's going to be better prepared for when it comes his way. He's going to read the last page of his book, just in case he dies so he knows how the book ends. Now, many of us might say something similar. We can imagine a future when we've had a life well lived, where we imagine that, you know what, I'm ready, right? But will that future ever materialize like we picture it? It's easier to think like that when death seems far off in the future. But, as Gray points out, the future you is imagined, and the present you is the only real you. So when you meet death, it's not far off in the future, it's always in the now. Will you really be ready then? Will you really be ready in the now? Or are we only comfortable with death when it's in a distant and imaginary future? Is it any real consolation that at least you read the last page of your book so you know how it ends? So, if you're the other kind of disposition, if you take the problem of suffering and death in the world seriously for you, the question is, do you see a real solution? You recognize the problem, do you see a real solution? Again, just because it's natural that we get this big list of things that cause suffering and death doesn't mean that we should accept them. It's better to not settle for the natural evils that are wrong in this world, but to see them as problems that need a solution, as Gray said. Now, we can treat these things as an urgent to-do list, and I would say that in a lot of ways, that is a noble pursuit. If you're pursuing something to reduce human death and suffering, I want to affirm that's a good thing. But we are still hostages of death. Death has so much power over us, it has claimed literally everyone that has lived before us, with one exception, and can claim anyone living now. Now, we can delay death, we can reduce suffering, but that is not a satisfactory or final answer to death. Now, so I do think we should think about death. We should give it some serious thought about what the final answer to death might be. Now, you can ruin your life if you become preoccupied with death and you see no real solution. That was Sally's criticism of Harry. You're going to ruin your life thinking about death all the time. Now, Scripture speaks about a real solution to death. Let me set the scene for you. From Ezekiel 37, verse 1. The hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. You got the picture? Verse 3. He asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? I said, Sovereign Lord, you alone know. This might be the most powerful verses in this particular lesson. Can these bones live? What a question. Can life be brought back to overcome death? And the answer is God alone can do that. Notice what he calls him, Sovereign Lord. God is sovereign. God is in control. He has power over things. You see, in the Christian view, if God is who we think he is, then miracles are possible. If God is who we think he is, then miracles are possible. We're going to get more into why that is in future lessons, but for now, all I'm going to say is that Christians believe that God can work the miracle of answering death with life. Verse 4, then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. Now, just that right there, I think, is kind of funny. Speaking to dry bones, it's just kind of a funny image to me. I mean, it seems pointless. How are the bones going to hear what you're saying, right? And as a preacher who sometimes speaks to people who are falling asleep, or sometimes people who are dead asleep, like, I get that feeling. Why am I speaking to them? It seems pointless. But this shows how this is such good news. See, God has an answer to death that can reverse death even for those who have died before us. That is so beyond any of the other solutions that we have within our human power. That's why everyone needs to hear this good news, even the dry bones, because it's for all of us, even those who have already died. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. You see, if God can reverse death and bring new life, then we know that God is who he says he is. Verse 11, then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the people of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. So Ezekiel continues. He has this powerful imagery of the bones coming back to life. But he can explain. So he's like, you can think of these dry bones coming back to life as a metaphor for the people of God, metaphor for people who are without hope. Now, let me be clear. God's solution for death, it's not a metaphorical solution, but a literal solution. God can bring new life to both our spiritual and corporeal deaths, right? God's solution is that all-encompassing. It's that much of a big solution. But when it says these bones are like the people of Israel, it's kind of like saying, it's kind of like what we would say when someone's no fun, we would call them like a wet blanket, or, oh, you're just a stick in the mud. Ezekiel's saying someone who is without hope, they're dry bones. They are spiritually dead. That's what dry bones means. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says, my people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back. So to people who are spiritually and literally dead, God can bring us back. That's why the images of the dry bones being brought back to life is so powerful. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you and you will live. So if God can show us these answers to death, we know that God who is who he says he is, and that is a good thing. So let's return to When Harry Met Sally. See, the application for this lesson depends on where you're at. Whether you're more like Sally and have a hard time wrestling with what's really wrong with the world, or more like Harry, who's preoccupied and crushed by what's wrong with the world. For each person, there's an application, and for each one, there's something to do and something to avoid. So let me walk you through the application. What's wrong with the world? If you're like Sally, don't settle for the miseries of the world just because they're natural. Call evil things evil. Dare to hope for something better instead. That's if you're in that camp, that kind of disposition. But if you're more like Harry, the application for you is don't be discouraged. Don't drive yourself crazy with your preoccupation with death, because there's real hope to be found in Jesus. So that's this lesson. What's wrong with the world? We've talked about everything that's wrong in the world in this lesson, right? That was super easy, right? Not heavy at all, right? Now, I want you to remember these concepts of how very few people say that there's nothing wrong with the world, the concept of human evil, what we call sin, or natural evil. What's really wrong with natural things is that they cause suffering and death. I want you to remember these concepts because we're going to be exploring them in future weeks. So this week we talked about what is wrong with the world. Next week is the why question. Why the world is broken, right? We're going to better understand how the world got the way that it is so that we can better understand how God is correcting it. And that's plenty for today. My prayer is that you can better see what the problem is so that you can better understand what God's solution is.